The Fed, knowingly or not, is basically in charge of the global financial system. They may shout, "We raised rates in the US to fight inflation, global consequences be damned." But that's a hell of a lot more difficult to follow when large G7 countries are in the early stages of a full-blown currency crisis. The most serious implication is that the Fed is responsible for supplying dollars to everyone. When they raise rates, they trigger a margin call on the entire world. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we are getting into a read today from the Dollar Endgame Substack. This is Peruvian Bull, which I think we've read a couple of pieces by the Bull on this show. It's been a good little while. And I usually try to steer away from, granted, the Peruvian Bull really never writes them dry. He's a pretty entertaining writer, and especially in covering kind of the macro situation and what's going on with treasury markets and debt markets and GDPs and all of that good stuff. I've always appreciated writing on that that's a little more lively. And the Peruvian Bull has one for us today. This was actually came out on August the 4th, so it's a couple weeks old now. Godzilla Returns. And it is about the Japanese debt markets and currency markets, the USD to yen ratio. And basically everything that's been going on with their central bank, their overall situation, and how to potentially see and understand how this could affect the United States and vice versa, what we're doing in the United States and how it could affect them. So this will be a fun one, and we'll get into it in just a minute. Just a shout out to Cold Card for supporting this show, or CoinKite, the makers of the Cold Card, for supporting this show. And don't forget that you can get a discount code if you're picking up your Cold Card Q or the Cold Card Mark IV by going to the link directly in the show notes and using the code you will find there, Bitcoin Audible, all one word. And it's also a huge help for this show. So thank you, and shout out to everybody on Fountain who does Value for Value and StreamSats and Boost, and all the other podcasting apps that are podcasting 2.0 compatible, which is actually a number of them now. I got exposed to another couple in just the recent weeks. If you haven't checked that out yet, it's a really fun way to use Bitcoin. And also, you should give me sats. If you want to try it out, that would be a great way to do it. You could just send me sats, and then you would find out how great it is for me to get more sats. I'll zap you back on Nostr. Don't worry, I got you. All right, with that, let's get into today's read by the Peruvian Bull, the Dollar Endgame Substack. And it's titled Godzilla Returns by the Peruvian Bull. The Japanese, in a desperate bid to save their failing currency, have now begun hiking rates. The USD-JPY, or dollar-to-yen price, has been collapsing, and with it, the carry trade that held up their massive, over-leveraged economy. Are the Japanese finally choosing to save the currency at the cost of everything else? On July 31st, in a surprise move, the Bank of Japan hiked interest rates by 25 basis points, or a quarter of 1%. Markets were expecting only a 10 bips increase, so this move caught them off guard, along with the hawkish wording of the policy statement from Bank of Japan Governor Ueda. Following Ueda's news conference, the Japanese currency appreciated to a range of 150 to 151 yen per dollar. This was a big change from the day before, when USDJPY was trading at 154 yen. In the month of July alone, the government reportedly spent around $36 billion intervening in currency markets to support the yen, as per data released on Wednesday. These currency interventions have come because the BOJ has sleptwalked into a trap. As I've covered in depth before, all countries, except for global reserve currency holders like the United States, face something called the impossible trilemma. Countries can pick two of the three corners, but must give up the third corner as a sacrificial lamb. All three corners cannot hold, at least not in the long run. The free flow of capital, independent monetary policy, and fixed exchange rates. Most countries need a free flow of capital. This is called, in economics, an open capital account. Open bank accounts that allow transfers and settlement of currency across the border, including credit and short-term debt instruments that are cash-like in nature, such as repos. For Japan, this is crucial, as they are heavily involved in world trade. Independent monetary policy is still important, but not as crucial as an open capital account for most foreign nation states. This is not to say it has no value, as a home economic crisis can spur a country to shift from the status quo, and that can be beneficial to saving their domestic financial system. The question remains, who is the monetary policy, quote, independent from? The answer, quite clearly, is the Federal Reserve. Recall that as the dollar is the global reserve currency, it is used in 53% of all international trade invoices, 80% of inter-regional trade settlement, 58% of global forex reserves. The euro-dollar system, which are offshore dollars, is in excess of $100 trillion in derivatives, bank balances, loans, and credit instruments. The entire globe is tied to the dollar, like I laid out in my piece, Sword of Damocles. Quote, the Fed, knowingly or not, is basically in charge of the global financial system. They may shout, we raise rates in the U.S. to fight inflation, global consequences be damned. But that's a hell of a lot more difficult to follow when large G7 countries are in the early stages of a full-blown currency crisis. The most serious implication is that the Fed is responsible for supplying dollars to everyone. When they raise rates, they trigger a margin call on the entire world. Close quote. When the Fed began their hiking cycle in March of 2022, we saw massive pressure building on the Japanese financial system, and this resulted in their currency starting to blow out. This pressure continued throughout the spring and summer of this year. In late April, the BOJ held a disastrous press conference that saw USD-JPY move up by 3 yen just during the course of the discussions. Officials quickly panicked and authorized two interventions, one after the other in quick succession. In total, the Ministry of Finance, working with the central bank, spent 9 trillion yen, or around $55 billion, in currency interventions between these two moves. Recall that they have around $100 billion in USD in liquid cash and $1 trillion USD in treasury bonds, both of which could be used theoretically to defend their currency, keeping it around the 150 to 160 level. The goal with these interventions was simple: blast the shorts with as much firepower as possible, as randomly as possible, to instill fear and prevent new carry traders from opening positions. Remember that carry trades borrow in one currency and lend or invest in another, capturing the spread between the two and pocketing it. They often lever up this trade to juice returns, so carry is a short volume strategy. Typically, carry traders will hedge one or both sides of their trade so that chances of being margin called are low or non-existent. However, the cost of setting up and maintaining swaps to do so eat into the carry profits. Japan was a large funding mechanism for carry traders first because of their zero-bound interest rates, which make it extremely cheap to borrow in yen. At one point, with certain time deposits rates were even negative, which meant borrowers got paid to take out loans. But the other reason why Japan built up such a massive carry trade, with Deutsche Bank analysts estimated at a staggering 20 trillion USD equivalent, is because of the lack of volatility in the monetary policy itself. The Bank of Japan was adjusting their QE, their YCC bands, but the actual base interest rate, the one charged for reserve loans from the central bank itself, had not changed. This is crucial since just like the Fed funds rate, the BOJ policy rate is the benchmark upon which all the other rates are judged. When it moves, the entire rate complex moves, at least in theory. As this rate has remained at negative 10 basis points since 2016, there has been essentially zero volatility in one entire leg, the funding leg of the carry trade. This makes carry much more profitable than it otherwise would be, as traders don't have to pay to hedge this risk, or have to worry about getting blown up. The stability provided here by the bank encouraged more and more carry traders to jump in headlong into this trade, which ultimately put the aforementioned pressure on their currency, so much so that it devalued 50% within 2 years. The Japanese public is the one paying the price, of course, and the central bankers, who are accountable to no one, continued this insane policy for years. This pressure continued in July, and on the 11th, the ministry engaged in yet another yentervention. Market analysts estimated this one at 5.71 trillion yen, but the Ministry of Finance confirmed at the end of the month that it was 5.53 trillion yen, or about 36.8 billion US dollars, a bit larger than either one of the first two in late April and early May of this year. Japanese authorities usually don't confirm immediately if they've intervened in currency markets, but often warn they're ready to step in if there's too much, quote, speculative trading. Again, they have a lot of dry powder for this, with $1.23 trillion in foreign reserves as of late June. The weak yen is highly unpopular with the public and might be a key issue in the ruling party's leadership elections in September. However, any future intervention will be under new leadership, as Masato Kanda finished his term as Japan's top currency diplomat on Tuesday. Atsushi Mimura, the new Vice Finance Minister for International Affairs, mentioned in an interview that intervention is still an option. Now the geniuses at the helm of Japanese monetary policy have tried a new tactic, raising rates. On Wednesday, July 31st, the Bank of Japan raised its benchmark interest rate to 0.25%, continuing to wind down its monetary stimulus policy that has been in place for most of the past 25 years. The rate was previously between 0% and 0.1%, having just moved from negative just a few months ago. Additionally, the bank announced plans to gradually cut its government bond purchases by half, reducing them to 3 trillion yen a month, or around 20 billion, by early 2026, essentially a, quote, taper of the easing that they have long been undertaking. Markets had expected no change to rates, so this hike was a shock to all participants. BOJ Governor Katsuo Ueda didn't rule out another rate hike this year and stated that the bank is ready to keep raising borrowing costs to what's considered a, quote, normal level for the economy. This tough stance pushed the dollar below 151 yen for the first time since March. Under Ueda's leadership, the BOJ has raised rates by a total of 35 basis points in just 4 months. Wednesday's hike was the biggest since a 25 basis point increase in February 2007, the last major policy tightening before a long period of extreme monetary stimulus designed to boost sluggish aggregate demand. The hike had immediate consequences. As we see above, the yen immediately started appreciating against the dollar, steadily dropping to 146 against the dollar. All the USD/JPY carry traders who are functionally short the yen on the funding leg now are getting stopped out as the steamroll begins. All this leverage, which was pushing the yen into the 160s, is now unwinding in spectacular fashion, much to the chagrin of Ueda and others who desperately wanted to stop the currency crisis in its tracks. However, the cost to be paid will be steep. Recall that after the last two decades of zero interest rates and yield curve control, Japanese public debt to GDP stands at a whopping 263%, and the private debt to GDP north of 120%. If the BOJ actually wants to normalize rates with the Fed, their federal government would be paying 13% of their annual GDP alone in interest expense. 13%. The market reactions have already been severe. On Friday morning, the benchmark Nikkei stock average was down 4% at 36,588 after dropping as much as 5.3% earlier. In the past 5 years, the index has seen a daily drop of more than 4% only at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. The Nikkei 225 closed a massive 5.8% lower, making its biggest daily drop since March of 2020. Earlier this year, the Japanese stock index had finally hit record highs, boosted by stronger corporate earnings due to a weak yen, the return of modest inflation, and improvements in corporate governance. It had retaken the critical 38,000 level that was reached in 1990 before the slow-rolling deflationary collapse had crippled the economy. That is quickly coming undone, as we can see in this 3-month chart using 1-hour candles. In fact, the entire year's gains have been almost completely wiped out due to the price action from the last few days. Fund managers had a knee-jerk flight to, quote, safety by buying Japanese financials, who could profit from the weaker yen. This worked Thursday, as the Japan Bank ETFs were up 1% as the rest of the market sold off, but this soon reversed. Friday saw a bloody day for virtually every single Japanese financial firm, with the average company losing a whopping 10% in a single day. Elsewhere in Asia on Friday, markets fell sharply. South Korea's KOSPI dropped 3.7%. Australia's S&P ASX 200 fell 2.1%. Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index fell by 2.1%. And China's Shanghai Composite was down 0.9%. This is the deflation they wished for. Remember, it is possible to get a stronger currency, but it comes at a steep cost. The brilliant central planners are going to have to brace for a much worse repeat of the 1990s crisis. Since this time, the debt to GDP is much higher, and their demographic situation is even worse. And all this with just a quarter basis point increase. They have to do this 20 more times to catch up with the Fed. Currency crisis or deflationary collapse. It looks like the Japanese have now chosen a new Godzilla. I have heard multiple stories and read a number of posts about people losing their phones and with it their Bitcoin in just the past few days. So we're going to take the cold card sponsor slot to just for a PSA, get a backup ritual and perform it every single time. And legit plan your backup ritual. It's extremely easy, but actually plan it and write down the steps. Like legitimately take your hand, find a pen and paper and write it down. Step one, I'm going to write down the location of the wallet. So it's like on my phone, it's nunchuck, it's green, whatever. Step two, I'm going to write down the seed phrase. 12 words or 24 words. Then step three, I put it in my safe space or a safety deposit box or whatever it is. And just do it every single time. Even if you're just playing around with a random wallet, do it for the sake of practice, of just making it a habit. And it does a couple of things. Not only does it make it a habit, but it also forces a fresh reminder of where and how to get your other seeds. Because another problem is actually just forgetting what you did and where stuff is. And for everybody who's saying, oh, but then the police could get it or somebody, a thief might get it, it's important to understand the order of operations when it comes to risks. Most keys are lost because they are merely lost, or a phone is destroyed and you can't recover it. And I'm certain that most of you out there who use Bitcoin all the time, it's probably not going to be devastating, but eventually you're going to lose coins this way. So have a simple process, and if you want to know that your keys are safe, this is why you get a hardware wallet like the Cold Card. To keep it safe, you get a card and an SD slot in order to back up your wallets. And it literally kind of walks you through the process just during the setup of the hardware wallet itself. But holding your own keys, I think, is the most important thing, and then follow that with getting a solid backup ritual. Then you can start thinking about multi-sig and separating things out if you want to, but for most people, the overwhelming majority of the time, you just need a good hardware wallet to keep your keys safe. And you know, the sovereign future isn't some distant place. It's right now. You just have to go out and get the sovereignty and implement it. You have to know how to. And if you just get a hardware wallet and hold your own keys, you are building a sovereign foundation for yourself and your future. If you want to snag a cold card because they have a fantastic device, and I love those guys over there, you can use my discount code, which is also a huge help because it supports me and lets them know that I am the one that sent you. So you're not only getting a discount, you're also supporting this show. Thank you guys. Keep your Bitcoin safe and perform your backup ritual every single time. You will thank me. One day you will thank me for that. So I was really curious about kind of digging into some of the specifics on what happened with the yen and everything a week or so, 2 weeks ago maybe now. And this, I felt, was a decent summary article of basically how things are starting to unfold for anybody who was also curious and hadn't really kept up with it. But I think it just illustrates the point really well, the dichotomy of having to choose between a massive deflationary crisis and essentially hyperinflation, but also partly how long it can go on before it turns into something that is truly precipitous. A ton of modern countries have been getting away with a get out of jail free card on inflation for a pretty long time now. I mean, in the grand scheme, when you're talking about like monetary trends and time frames, not really. It's actually all been insanely fast. But when you look at recent history and the age of certain regimes and price control systems, and also the general age of fiat systems, we've actually gone a good little chunk of time before really having to pay the Pied Piper. And there's also something else to consider here is, it's very likely that we bounce back and forth between each of these in a very long, drawn-out process, because I doubt any institution or modern government or central bank or regulatory agency, whatever it is unlikely to go bullheaded in any particular direction after seeing a reaction, which means that we might just continue to accelerate these backs and forths that I believe have kind of moved down from 15-year cycles to kind of 3 to 4 year cycles almost. And then as we really reach a seeming hockey stick point to a lot of the deficit and debt problems and how things are basically folding back in on themselves in relation to GDP, which GDP itself isn't even a good measurement. GDP, I think a good way to think about GDP is it's a measure of the sustained activity that the new inflation causes. In a sense, it's what the inflation and the new amounts of debt can actually afford, but it's in nominal terms. So it reacts to the new inflation. Like if you just issue a ton new credit and issue a ton new money into the system, it's going to raise GDP. And it's not because the economy is healthier or that we have more stuff. It's literally because there's just more money flowing in the economy. It's just like putting more mercury into the thermometer to get a higher temperature, or taking it out to get a lower temperature. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't change any of the resources. The temperature didn't actually change. They're just manipulating the bucket and how it's measured. But what's funny is that GDP will never actually be able to catch up with the rate that the actual money is issued and the new debt is created into the economy. It will always have a negative balance because debt is a net negative destruction of resources. If you don't put all of it back, if you don't balance the budget, well, then we're just net loss. We the actual resources in the economy, we just lost value rather than gained. So growth that you do that is performed with savings is growth that you can keep. Growth that you get by the expansion of debt is growth that you owe back with interest. So when your GDP goes up, it's not meaningful at all because we owe it all back. It's like saying you got higher pay because you now put $1,000 on your credit card every month as a matter of saying this is part of my income. You don't have a higher income. But what's interesting is that it still represents a relationship. It represents a gap between the amount of money and debt issued versus what you're actually seeing as a shift in the economy, which is why you just keep adding those few percent points over and over and over again. And so GDP as a nominal metric doesn't really matter. The debt as a nominal metric doesn't really matter. Doesn't matter whether you have a billion tons of gold or you have one ton of gold. It can still just be divided up and prices will just be according to those units. I mean, you could go to your local farmer and pay $20 for a pound of extremely high quality steak, or you could go and pay 20 trillion Zimbabwean dollars, but it doesn't matter. It's just about the relative units to each other and the ability to measure that steak or that meat against a chicken or against a rubber tire, whatever it is. But the nominal amount is totally irrelevant. It could be anything. It could be 100 Satoshis, 0.00001 Bitcoin, $20 or 20 trillion Zimbabwean dollars. Doesn't matter. But the amount that you go into debt related to the amount you have available to spend does matter. Now, if you're going $20 in debt, 20 Zimbabwean dollars in debt, and you're spending 20 trillion, you don't have a problem because you're 0.00001% debt to GDP ratio. You're golden. Just like if you went into debt 100 Satoshis today, you would not be, that would not bother you. You could forget about payments on that for a very, very long time, and it would not be a problem. I mean, your clothes probably lose more than 100 sats worth of value every single time you put them in the washing machine. But if your debt is 20 septillion Zimbabwean dollars and it costs $20 trillion for a good steak, well, then you have a very, very significant problem. And so this is how I think about the only usefulness of the GDP metric, in my opinion. It can measure half decently a relationship to debt. But from a nominal, quote-unquote, growth position as to what's happening with the GDP in relation to itself is completely meaningless. Outside of genuinely deflationary events, like huge deleveraging events and bankruptcies and collapse and shutting down of financial institutions and all these other things, like basically recessions and depressions, besides those events, if you print more money and issue more debt into the economy, your GDP is going to basically go up. It's going to go up until something is literally breaking, and then it's going to go down. But the up doesn't mean you had growth or that anything got better. The up just means that there's more money in the economy, like nominally. Like we're just moving from the $20 to the 20 trillion Zimbabwean dollars. We're just moving on that path. But its relationship to everything else is still the only thing that matters. Same as if you put more mercury in the thermometer, then what you need to do is you need to change where the numbers are on the thermometer so that it's still accurately measuring the temperature. So I want to read off, just so you can get an idea of where we're at and really kind of step back and look at the big picture here. I looked up the 10 largest debt to GDP countries. This is based on 2023 data, by the way. And also, this is specifically government and public debt, so government and central bank. Japan comes in number one at a staggering rate. So the 2023 numbers, which if you just heard in earlier in the article, I think he said 263% or something like that, which is probably more recent data. But last year it was 255%. Greece comes in at 168%. Singapore at 168%. Italy at 144%. The United States at 123%, France at 110%, Portugal 108%, Spain 107%, Canada 106%, and Belgium 106%. The G7 average is 128%. And up until today, the worst it has ever been in United States history was 112%, right at the end of World War II. And also keep in mind that this does not track what's happening with the private sector, with the people themselves, and how much credit card or leverage or anything, what is in the economy versus that. A great example is in the roaring 20s, or just into the early 1930s, the total private debt got over 200%. So it was just running up during the 20s and then got exacerbated by the crash that it caused right at the beginning of the 30s. And that was the boom-bust debt cycle caused by manipulating the price. So it caused the roaring 20s while the debt was able to expand. And then it unraveled in 29, 30, 31, and it started to decline. And we had this prolonged Great Depression where the government attempted to fix everything that was falling apart, when all of the falling apart was just the correction. It was the attempt to cut what was losing and stop destroying resources, and the government did everything they could to prop it up so we would keep destroying resources. And that's why it prolonged for 10 years, which had never happened before. The government went on the largest and most comprehensive price control, subsidy, government contracts, socializing systems, government spending spree, and manipulation spree that the United States had literally ever witnessed. And there was a 10-year depression. It is quite comical that we are taught that the government saved us with a fantastic plan, the New Deal, when it is literally famous for being the worst economic period, like, forever. It's like somebody coming out with the cure for cancer today, and then for the next 10 years, everyone is treated with it, and literally more people die from cancer than have ever died from cancer, ever. Then people start taking it a whole lot less, and everything kind of clears up and it goes back to normal. And then the history books teach us how great it was that we finally cured cancer. Because look how bad it was during these 10 years. But anyway, Japan is not in a good way. 255%. But that's like kind of what worries me, is that this could just drag on so bad. And we also don't know exactly what kind of runway the U.S. has to make this, to consolidate this risk and make the problem bigger and bigger before things to start unravel. Because now we're the reserve currency of the whole world. So all of those other currencies tend to kind of collapse into the dollar. And the G7 average, like, we have done this in lockstep. We've all done the exact same awful, terrible crap policy together as like a group of friends. Hey guys, you want to just burn down all of our houses? Hell yeah, I'll do it with you, man. And if you didn't gather how bad the situation was, remember that this whole article, I love the way that he ends this article, is going through the 10% average decline in all of the companies in the Nikkei 225, literally clearing out years of gains, and that they're literally in the same situation as they were in the 1990s, except much worse on basically all metrics. And all of this reaction was all just because of a quarter basis point increase. 0.25%. That's the interest rate. I want to try to make you think about what that means. Remember, this is the cost of using up capital today at the expense of tomorrow. So just think of anything that you own. Let's go with your house. Would you rent out your house for 0.25%? Would you let someone else use up those resources, but still own the house for 0.25%? Just so you understand what kind of quote-unquote rental fee we are having on those resources. 0.25% of a $300,000 home is $750. That is renting your house to somebody else for $750 per year. That's 62 buckaroos per month. Would you rent out a lawnmower that you spent $1,000 on. Really nice riding lawnmower. Actually, hold up. I'm curious what those are even, what that stuff is even priced at. I haven't looked at this. I bet this is bad. I'm showing my age right now that I think $1,000 is a riding lawnmower, I bet you. Holy crap, $2,500? $2,500 for a basic riding mower? Okay, $2,500 for a basic riding mower. Would you lend this out to someone for $6? $6.25 per year, which is a whopping 52 cents a month. 2 quarters and 2 pennies for someone to use up your riding mower. What's the condition of that going to be like at the end of a year? What can you sell a 1 year used mower for? Hell, I guess we can actually look that up too. Let's see mower prices. We got, we're on Facebook Marketplace. We got random 550, 400, 200. These are all the riding, 700. 800. Let's call it 1,000. Oh, here's one with 1,000. Here's one pretty good condition for 1,200. You know what? Let's be nice. Let's just say it only loses $500 because the people you rented it to are just absolutely immaculate. They care more about your mower than you could think of anyone else caring for a mower. For one that you bought for $2,500 and is now worth $2,000, you have $6.25 in your pocket. And because it's been a year, the new mowers now cost $28.99 because there is a Labor Day sale from their $29.99 actual price. And you have $6.25 in your pocket. And luckily, at the end of the month, you will get another quarter and another quarter and 2 pennies right behind them, with which you will need to hire someone to mow your lawn because you don't have a mower. This is the interest rate that central banks of the modern world are trying to force onto markets as the cost of eating up resources. Do you suspect the market price would be any different from this? Do you feel so exorbitantly rich that handing your house over for $62 a month seems like a pretty reasonable price? And this interest rate has caused havoc in the markets. Now, if you also want to understand the Cantillon effect and just how powerful this is to manipulate who is able to access and own resources, you obviously don't get 0.25% on your credit card. You don't get a 0.25% interest rate on your mortgage. You don't get to rent or borrow a car or get a loan for a car at 0.25%. However, some of the largest banking and corporate institutions in the economy do get loans. Hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars worth of loans at like 1, 2, 3% interest rate. Because of this lie, they essentially get to borrow your mower at like $1.50 a month. But they don't directly borrow your mower. What they do is they buy the conglomerate that owns the company that makes your mower. And they charge you 18% interest, which you pay to them to buy the overpriced mower that just went up $500 in price. They get the cheap debt, own all of the assets, and then you pay their interest by paying the higher price. I mean, if you could rent a $300,000 house today for $60 a month, would you take that opportunity? What if it was $300 a month? A $300,000 house, would that be worth it to you? What if you were getting that interest rate, but everybody else in your neighborhood was paying 8%? That's about $2,000 per month. Do you think it would give you an advantage if you could rent the median household at $300 a month while everybody else did it at $2,000 a month? Do you suspect that that would mean you would have a much, much nicer house than everybody? Because you would probably still go towards what you could afford, maybe $1,500 a month, which means you actually go buy like a $1 or $2 million house. Now, obviously, this isn't exactly how it happens, because if the system were that blatant, there would literally be riots before tomorrow morning. So it's more like when you get that interest rate and you get that cantillionaire advantage, you don't go buy a $2 million house with your interest rate, because the government doesn't even want that to be a part of an option on the table because of how blatant and obvious it would be that they're scamming the entire system. So they only let you buy financial instruments and certain bonds and certain indexes and stuff. So what you do is you actually, rather than taking out a $2 million loan to go buy a $2 million house at your special interest rate, what you do is you take out a $30 billion loan at your special interest rate and buy a bunch of an index that holds a bunch of funds that invest and package a bunch of mortgages at 10,000 houses at a time. You buy that up, and then the company that you now own that is managing all of those houses rent it to all of your neighbors at $2,000 a month. And suddenly, there's an entire industry. And then a sub-industry, and then a sub-industry under that one, that are all eating away and fighting each other for this $1,700 difference between the giant conglomerate, multi-deca-billion-dollar financial instruments and the $2,000 that they're charging you. And out of nowhere, it's the finance guy that's buying the $2 million house in the neighborhood. And just 0.25% sent the Japanese economy and stock market into utter turmoil. If this doesn't illustrate how off the mark the interest rates are from reality, then I don't have a better demonstration at the moment. I guess I'll keep working on it. So I think this is a good thing to picture too, when you're looking at a city that's rotting, or a poor and middle class that are constantly getting poorer, and houses are getting a little crappier, and people have less and less time to keep up with them. They have less and less time to keep up and focus on their family. And so their kids get outsourced to public schools and to programs and subsidies, and they, you know, do childcare or manipulate and change their behavior and change their economic decisions because of subsidies or tax breaks or whatever. And now decisions are totally polar opposite to what they had been otherwise. Potholes don't get fixed. Lawns don't get cut. You see this gradual and constant rotting and degradation of society, all while you see crazy development and shiny new stuff on some other edge of the city. And the government's doing some giant works and building program and building a nice new highway when literally all of the other roads are chock full of potholes. They're not fixing the stuff that they have. They're just trying to put a banner in front of something new and then pointing at all the jobs they make. And you're trying to understand why and how this is happening. I want you to just think about it in terms of the interest rate. Is the debt, is the interest that's being charged for the people who are building new stuff right now matching the amount of rot that is going on the old roads? I mean, that's kind of what the interest rate is. It's the market's attempt to price the amount of rot and degradation and maintenance and the cost in keeping something in the state that we originally got it in, keeping something new and stable and sustainable, instead of using those resources for building another road that we can't keep up with, or another house that we're not going to be able to keep up with. You know, a really great book to think about this idea is Strong Towns. He does a great job of just kind of breaking down the practical realities of our fiscal situation. And it's from a previously Keynesian city planner who just realized that the way they were calculating all of these things was just totally wrong. And if you've got a 30-year loan to pay off a house or a street or whatever, if you've gone into debt in order to pay for that, and then when you pay it off, when you finally own it, that it already needs to be replaced, that you've already got another loan just to fix the potholes, just to repave this whole half of it, then that is the definition of ground reality unsustainable. And the last thing we need to do, if that's our situation, is go build something else, because we can't afford to maintain the stuff that we have now. Like, if you're losing $500 a month on your house that you're trying to maintain and rent out to somebody else, if every month you're losing money on that and you can't keep up because you're not charging a high enough price to handle the maintenance payments and everything that goes on with owning the actual house and keeping it in rentable condition, the very last thing that you should do is go into debt again and buy another house that is also losing $500 a month. Yeah, it looks good, and it puts people to work for the year or so that it takes to build this house and get all the contracts and permits and plans and everything together. But it is not a solution to your financial situation. It just means that after you are finally done, you have a second house that is rotting faster than you are making money off of it. This is why things are falling apart. Because this is the dynamic that we have with the price of debt. The cost of using up capital of any kind whatsoever across the entire economy is being price controlled by central banks and being funneled through a Cantillon class and a sub-industry built just to parasite off of the Cantillon class and another subset of parasites underneath that, all the way down to where almost everything in the economy is just infected with politics. Because political money is the thing that owns everything. That's just the result. That's what happens when you put price controls on the cost, the general broad cost of just using up resources. This is why it costs $3,000 to repaint your house and you can't afford it, instead of it costing $500 and you could afford it. This is why houses don't get repainted. Because we already allocated those resources somewhere else at a price that you never, ever, ever would have agreed to. But they have a really great Ponzi scheme going on in which they package it and repackage it and stick it into a company and then make it into an index and then sell it to giant multinational deca-billion-dollar and trillion-dollar corporations and financial institutions. Because that's just a big giant wall of confusing and jargon that makes it really hard to understand that they're just ripping us the fuck off. And thus, it continues. And then when the giant cantillionaire multi-billion dollar conglomerate that bought CNN and MSNBC and Fox and every other news station in the world and just pumps out 24 hours a day that monkeypox is the reason that it's all falling apart, everybody basically believes them because that's a whole lot easier to understand than they ripped us off through a giant hierarchical political system of monetary manipulation and gross over-financialization of everything in the entire economy, and that there are literally industries and standards and regulatory agencies and insurance companies and lawyer contracts and agreements built all around this giant scamming system, and that it literally siphons trillions upon trillions of dollars from the middle class and the poor up to the rich just because they're fewer hops away from the price lie that the central bank forces on the economy. The other one's just a whole lot easier to believe. And they're going to say the other one like a whole bunch. Like, they're not going to bother to try to explain the reality to you, especially not in the institutions and the news organizations that they own. And honestly, even if they understand it, they're probably lying to themselves, like very viciously, like massive amounts of denial, saying that, you know, it would just be a whole lot worse if somebody else was in charge. It's super easy to convince yourself that you're the hero, especially when you're stupid wealthy, and all of that wealth and power actually depend upon your being the hero. But then, of course, some of them are just evil pieces of crap, and they are literal scum of the earth. But then, of course, there's tons of people in the middle and low class that just attach themselves to the cantillionaire industry to live off of them. And it really reorients everyone around simply working toward that apparatus, and where politics becomes this huge section of actually being able to get up the ladder, because more of the money is coming down the ladder from political control, from the manipulation and creation of debt through political and monopolistic government institutions, central banks. And when it gets this bad, You have one or two options. Either you deflate and you have an economic crisis because suddenly, you know, you realize you're losing $500 a month on two different houses at the same time. And because you can't now get another loan to make it appear as if we're building and hiring new people, you actually have to get rid of one of the houses. In fact, you probably have to sell both of the houses. And the government and central bank were lovely enough to make sure that all of your neighbors were in the exact same situation at the exact same time. And now there's like a bajillion houses for sale all at once. And everybody's actually letting them go for like $62. Because now the price of capital is actually real. And the mortgage has shot up to 30% because we have to make up for 20 years of lies. And it's either that or inflation. Let the price of the money eat away at the difference. Think about it. You might actually have that interest rate if your $2,500 new mower is actually still $2,500 next year because a new mower is $5,000. Well, now it seems like that $6 is actually really nice. And if you could do that 10,000 times, you'd be in a pretty good spot. And suddenly success is the ability to get low interest debt. Everybody else just eats it. It is some crazy times that we are living through. But I think this alludes back to where I think we are in the broader cycle, is that we're cascading back and forth between these two options. And it may even swing with the kind of political winds of, you know, whether we have a party A or party B in office, is they're basically having to clean each other's mess up and having to decide which is better. Like, when it comes to whether or not we're having awful inflation or we're having an awful economic recession and depression, then the decision will be, it'll make it look like the other option is the thing that needs to happen. So when inflation is really bad, oh, well, we need to take this up the interest rate and put this in check. And that'll actually work for some short period of time. And then in this situation, like with the Bank of Japan and the Nikkei, is something will crack after, you know, a couple of quarters go by. And there will be a big crash, and then they'll have to inject a ton of money because they're fixing what the last guy did and messed it all up. And this will probably just kind of keep going and keep accelerating until, you know, you're just in one, you have three cycles within one presidency or one cabinet, and they're all still blaming everything on the other guy. But the really weird thing about, you know, this is all really in, the Bank of Japan is really just kind of the future, right? It's just looking at, oh, well, what's going to happen to the rest of us as we head in that direction? Because we're all just moving in that direction. Like, none of the G7 is now over 100%, as they're all over 100%, or not all of them. The Germany and some other ones are further down, and they're like 70% or 60% debt to GDP. But everybody's growing. Debt is all just getting worse. So Japan is just a, look where we're headed. This is where we're going to be. How do you feel? And it'll be really interesting with the United States because there's a couple of dynamics at play that are odd and that we don't really have a fantastic historical example, at least not one with the amount of data that we have in the last, like, you know, 200 years on. But we are the world reserve currency, which means a lot of these are going to collapse into the dollar. Like, a lot of the capital outflows are actually going to bolster the dollar from these other fiat currencies until and or when Bitcoin is finally recognized as one of those things that capital should in mass escape to. But Bitcoin will also be a highly liquid asset that is easy to sell during the sell-offs in order to not get called on your leverage. So Bitcoin will literally be the equity that gets used to backstop some people's positions so that they aren't the ones that go bankrupt or get margin called, which will lead to sharp sell-offs in Bitcoin, followed probably by sharp runs. And honestly, this just might keep getting crazier for a pretty long time. Bitcoin's volatility will start to reflect the volatility of the world itself, of all of these policies, of all of the fiat system. Like, it's the mirror image. It's the other side of the coin. So obviously, it's going to be something that we'll keep up with on this show. A big shout out to Peruvian Bull and the Dollar Endgame. I try to keep up with that Substack when I can, recommended to people. There will be a link in the show notes if you want to check them out. And don't forget to make yourself a backup ritual and get yourself a cold card, because you will save yourself from a ton of pain if you do. And you can get a discount and support this show, which I really, really appreciate. And also shout out to all the guys who support me on Fountain and give me boosts and do value for value. Seriously, it makes a world of difference, especially right now, you know, Swan dropped and everything. So we're on the struggle bus. And I've got a lot of projects running all at once. And I hope there's some really, really exciting stuff to show you very, very soon. So please support if you can. Stay tuned, stay subscribed, share it out. All of those things help. And they will help when I finally have a lot of these things unfold to get more attention to them. You guys are, you're the reason this whole thing is successful. And let me know if I'm doing my job. What you want to see, what you want to hear. I'm curious. I love feedback. I love criticism. I mean, like, sometimes it pisses me off, but I'll grow up. I'm an adult. I can get over it. You think you have a valuable criticism? Let me know. Actually, some of the most appreciated ones are on Fountain, where I'll get somebody to be like, you were totally wrong about this, or I disagree with this whole episode. Here's 2,000 sats. That's actually pretty baller. Respect. But seriously, I'm really excited. I've got some things that have been in the works for a really, really long time. And I hope I'm not talking them up too much, because I'm just, it's still like right at arm's length. And I'm like, it's so close. But then everything takes 20 times as long as you think. It's like, okay, this will be done tomorrow. And like 9 days later, it's like, okay, we're halfway done with this thing that was going to be done 8 days ago. And then you realize it's because you scheduled 12 projects to be done in that one day. And you could only get a really little bit of each of those done. And so you get up and you do a little bit the next day. And slowly but surely, all of those projects inch forward. That's my life right now. It's been quite busy and quite overwhelming. But it's also a ton of fun. You know, I get to do this. Back to the whole Ross Stevens thing. It's pretty wild. I love it. I appreciate you guys so much. Support the show if you can. And it's so easy to make a big difference. Share it out. Let people know. Another shout out to Peruvian Bull. Don't forget to check out the link. He's got a number of other articles about the situation in Japan, and then also the situation in China and their banking collapse. Really fun stuff. In fact, some of that may be covered in the not too distant future on the show. We'll see. Actually, feel free to let me know if you want to dig into those. If you want me to be digging into, you know, what's going on in China, real estate and, you know, corporate and banking markets. I do have some sources that I can get into from a number of those things, but it's usually really dry to read. So shoot me suggestions. Let me know what you want to hear. I'm around. Always looking for good stuff. Holy crap, it's the longest outro ever. All right, guys. I am Guy Swan. This is Bitcoin Audible. And until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. For money, as for all other activities of man, liberty is the mother, not the daughter, of order. Murray N. Rothbard.